the real conversation. And some hard truths. Gangs, drugs, and guns. Giving a voice to those willing to sacrifice. We have stories that need to be told. We have lessons that need to be taught. Protect and serve. Welcome to The Quiet Professional.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. Nathan Romas with you. And today, you're going to have to get your dictionaries out, your thesaurus, because we got some big brain stuff coming at you. We've got Dr. Nicholas Carlton from the University of Regina. Nick is a professor of clinical psychology and registered doctoral clinical psychologist in Saskatchewan, and is currently serving as the scientific director for the Canadian Institute for Public Safety Research and Treatment. He's published more than 180 peer-reviewed articles exploring the fundamental basis of anxiety and related disorders. He's presented on hundreds of international conferences. He's been awarded more than $60 million in external funding, and he's actively involved in clinical and experimental research and currently serves as the principal investigator on the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Longitudinal PTSD Study. Yes, that's one title. And related public safety personnel studies. So welcome, doctor.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you for being on. And maybe right off the bat, can you tell us something like, does Shutter Island or Arkham Asylum, are those real things? Do those exist anywhere in the world?
Not as far as I know, but you know, I might not be high enough up the command chain to know if we actually have those around somewhere.
I like the part here about experimental research. I think people kind of always go, "Oh, I want to know the secrets about what's going on." So, I'm happy to have you here today, and we're going to talk a bit about you and how one becomes a professor of psychology and what that means, and then we'll talk a bit about some of your studies. So maybe we'll start at the beginning and tell us kind of where you come from and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. So I'm living in Regina right now. I'm at the University of Regina, but I was born in Edmonton. And it wasn't until a few years ago, I guess, that I really started reflecting on some of the events in Edmonton and how they probably influenced the choices that I ended up making later in life. So one of the first memories that I have, I was about 6 years old at the time. And my family was, my mother, who was pregnant with my younger brother at the time, we were in a terrible car accident, the three of us. And so we're in the car and we were T-boned by a drunk driver and pressed into a light post. It was quite the mess. And so that's one of the earliest memories that I have. And as part of that memory, what I know happened is there was a police officer who was just coming off duty. And that police officer just, by luck of the draw, happened to be walking down the street and witnessed the whole thing happen. And so he was the first one on the scene and rushed in. And like I said, he was a member of the EPS at the time. Rushed in, and he was the first person that was there literally trying to manage the crisis scenario that we were in there. My mother was really very badly injured. She ended up surviving, very fortunately. And my brother, with whom she was pregnant at the time, he ended up surviving as well. And I don't think I was too badly injured. But that was my first encounter that I can remember where we were working with a first responder or other public safety personnel. And when I look back on it now, from a more adult and educated perspective, I mean, that poor police officer, right? Like the guy had probably just finished a 12-hour shift and then started again in order to manage that situation, because that's what our police officers do. It's what all our public safety personnel do. They're never truly off duty. They're always there to serve and protect all of the rest of us. And there would have been a host of other people that ended up involved in that scenario, right? There were paramedics who showed up. The firefighters were there. They had to use the jaws of life to pry the car apart so we could get my mother out. There would have been the public safety communicators who would have been called in. There would have other police officers who showed up to manage the drunk driver and to manage the rest of the scene. Ultimately, at some point, there would have been a correctional worker or a series of correctional workers involved to manage the fact that we were hit by a drunk driver. So when you reflect on all of those things, there's a myriad of people that came together. And so my first experience with a police officer was literally one of them being a hero to try and help my family. Then as I went through my youth and went through school. I didn't actually plan to become a psychologist. I did my first undergraduate degree was actually in business administration, and then my second degree was in psychology, and I enjoyed it. And so shortly thereafter, I moved my way into working with the master's program, which you have to do if you want to eventually get a PhD. And the first project that we did was 9/11, or was focused on 9/11. So it was 2001 at the time, of course, and the planes had literally just crashed into the tower. And we began doing work evaluating the impact of witnessing that event on various different kinds of people. So after that, it was sort of one thing led to another. And before long, I was focused quite substantially on working with public safety personnel and trying to support their mental health. I became a professor of clinical psychology because most of the work I wanted to do was to try and help PSP with their mental health challenges, because we had anecdotal ideas in the beginning that they were really, they needed a lot more help. They needed better supports and better evidence-based supports than we had available at the time. So we started with some of the initial projects, but then it wasn't until 2016, where one of the pieces of work that we put out really sort of summarized the state of evidence at the time. And that was, we had been asked, it was late 2015, and I was a professor by this point, and I got asked by a few different chiefs just by chance in a 10-day window. They said, look, we're really starting to think that we're having some trouble with supporting our members' mental health. We're getting a lot of these programs that are being sold to us, where they're being advertised, mm-hmm. but we don't have the resources to buy all these things. Which one do we choose? And I said, well, you know, we'll go to the literature, and I'll come back and let you know what the evidence says. And when we went into the literature, much to our surprise, we found that there was almost no literature on these protective programs. There's almost no research on any of them. And this was 2015-ish. And so when we released that information to the public, people became quite concerned, going, well, we all depend on our PSP all the time, and we don't have enough evidence-based programming so that we can then provide the support back to them. Mm-hmm. So that started a bunch of watershed events that followed.
Well, and you're saying about the programs that the services, I guess they purchase them, or they have somebody come in and they pay them a speaker's fee. Most of those are, from what you've seen anyways, I guess not most of them, but just from what you've seen, those aren't evidence-based. They don't measure the outcomes and that you can actually see.
Yeah, that's the big challenge. So let's maybe just take a second and discuss what we mean by evidence-based. So it's a more complicated term than people recognize, but the way you framed it is really good. So if I say that something works and that it's evidence-based, really what I should be able to do is point to a peer-reviewed study that has gone at least one, hopefully many more than one, but at least one peer-reviewed study where somebody measured everybody before we did the program, somebody or the intervention or whatever it was, somebody measured them beforehand, mm-hmm. then they gave them the intervention or the program, then they measured them afterwards, and were able to show that they changed in the way that we expected. So they knew more than they knew before, or their mental health improved, or their skills improved, right? You should be able to have that program evaluation, and it should be done in such a way that it can pass independent blind peer review, so that basically people can critique it and assess it. And once you've got that kind of evidence, that's when we start to talk about something being evidence-based. Mm. And the vast majority, not all, but the overwhelming majority, there's hundreds of programs that are being proffered across the country right now, and the vast majority don't have that evidence base yet. Now, that doesn't mean they're necessarily bad or good or anything like that. It means that we don't know. Mm-hmm. And so we're strongly encouraging all of these programs and everybody working with these programs, like, let's invest the time and effort in figuring out what works for who, when, and why, so that we can make sure that we're giving our PSP the very best possible interventions and supports that we can make available for them, because they deserve nothing less.
And when you say peer-reviewed, just because I know that's a term that comes up quite a bit, at least in the podcasts I listen to, but some of the bigger names out there, like Jordan Peterson, Gad Saad, and they work in the world of psychology. What exactly is peer-reviewed, and why is it important?
That's a great question. So when I complete a research study, what I do next is I draft it into a manuscript. So it's a paper. Basically, it's a long paper that basically explains what I did and why and what I found and how I came to the conclusions that I did. And it's supposed to pretty transparently explain everything. And then what happens is I submit that to one of the journals, and we could have you and I could have a 3-hour or 10-hour even discussion and debate about different, you know, tiers of journals, which ones are better and why and whatever else have you. But let's place that aside for the moment. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to submit it to a journal, and the editor of that journal receives my paper, basically my manuscript. And usually there's more than me on it. Usually there's a host of different authors that work together on it. And they take that and they take away all of the or as much as they can, the identifying information. Then what they do is they send it to at least 2, usually 3 or 4 of my colleagues, not the ones that I know. So they've made it anonymous, and then they send it to 2 or 3 other psychology researchers in Canada, the United States, around the world. And they say, can you please evaluate this manuscript and the underlying work and tell us whether or not, like, what you think? So in my manuscript, I should have already said, here are the strengths and here are the weaknesses, because there's no perfect study. So it's going to say, you know, a strength might be I've got a really big sample. So there's 100, 200, 300 people who are participating in my project. Strength might be that I used a lot of different ways to evaluate the outcomes. A strength might be that I called my shot beforehand. Mm-hmm. So before I started doing the work, I posted it online somewhere where everybody could see, and I could say, I'm expecting that this is going to happen. So then these 2 colleagues, they don't know who I am, hopefully, and they go through, and their job is to critique the article, the manuscript, find where I made mistakes, what went wrong. And then if they think that there's not too many mistakes, and do they think that it meaningfully contributes to the literature, then they're going to provide some feedback and send it back to the editor. And then the editor takes a look at it and goes, okay, here you go, Nick. If you make the following, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 10 dozen changes, whatever it is, and address these concerns, then we're going to send it back to the peer reviewers and see if they agree you've addressed it. Then it goes back to them after I've addressed those concerns or tried to. And then the peer reviewers get another chance to decide if they think that now this is ready for prime time, so to speak. And if not, they send back more feedback. And if they do think it's ready for prime time, then they let us know. And at that point, then it gets published in the journal. And once it's published in the journal, then people know who had done the project. But that also then gives all of my colleagues everywhere around the world the opportunity to take a look at the study. And if they want, they can comment on it. Or they can try and replicate it to see, well, you know what, let's see if I can replicate Nick's results.
Is that?
Because if I can replicate Nick's results, that's a really good sign that the results are probably going to hold up.
So after they...
for more and more people. Sorry, Nathan, go ahead.
I was going to say, after they replicate it, is that the point at which they might cite it in their work? Or is it before, like, will people cite your work before that anybody's had that chance to replicate it?
They might. They might cite it beforehand. They might cite it as part of the replication. Sometimes they'll do both. Sometimes they'll cite it by saying, for example, if there's an intervention that we're trying, one of the things they might say is, look, there's 20 interventions that are potentially available, and these 3 interventions have at least 1 peer-reviewed article that says they work to do the thing we want. And so we're going to pick this one. And we'll use that intervention, even though it hasn't been replicated independently yet, because we need something, but at least this has peer-reviewed evidence behind it. So at least we're more comfortable that it's probably going to work. We hope that all of the research gets replicated, and that's to test to see, because there's always a chance that there was something special about the first time, right? So, and if there was something special about the first time, that's okay too. So let's say, for example, with the RCMP study that we'll talk about, let's say that the stuff that we're doing ends up working and it helps to protect the RCMP officer's mental health. Well, that's terrific, right? It's great news. And maybe we replicate it with more RCMP officers and we find, yep, it wasn't a one-off deal. It seems to be helping a lot of RCMP officers. Maybe we then try it with another group of PSP. So we try it, for example, with public safety communicators. If it works with them, that's terrific news, because it means that there are more people we can help. And it really then starts to say, yeah, this is a pretty robust intervention to protect mental health. But even if it doesn't work for them, that's still important scientific information, because now the question becomes, why didn't it work for them, but it did work for the RCMP? And if we can figure that out, then we can make adaptations to the program so that it can work for public safety communicators in the future. And then maybe those adaptations make it more likely to work for our correctional workers and our firefighters and our municipal police, our paramedics as well, our border services agents, right? So that's the process. And really, when we're talking about science and evidence base, it's not really, I don't want to say it's a forever process, but it's a very long process. So
I can see why you need lots of funding.
By the time we start saying it.
Oh, sorry.
You need lots of funding for it, but that's how we know that we're not throwing good money after bad, right? And that's also how we make things better every time. So when we first started treating people for post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, many, many years ago, or shell shock even before then, when they were first doing the initial treatments, 40, 50, 80 years ago, we were at the very beginning of trying to manage this. And so they were trying lots of different things. But it was that commitment to a scientific process that started to narrow down, well, okay, we're going to do this and not this. And for these people, most of the time, this intervention works and, you know, this one doesn't work as well. And that eventually leads to, you know, a handful of interventions that you can generally rely on as being helpful for most people most of the time. But it's a decade process, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And everything, it seems like there's always an endless amount of studies going on. I mean, we see it even with our job. We're testing out this equipment, even though other services have tested it. And I think we've run 6 or 7 tests on different pieces of the same equipment, whether it's a vest or a belt. And it makes you wonder, you know, everybody goes, well, why are we testing this again? And why am I, you know, we've got the Mounties have done it and the military's done it. Now we're going to do our own, like we know something better. So I guess that kind of answers that question too. One of the things I want to ask was, what is the process for getting a study going? So if you say, I want to study the effects of PTSD and whether we have a program that can help people with that. First of all, do you need to be a PhD to get funding? And then from there, how do you even begin to create a study? Because I imagine there's so much to consider. So what does that look like?
Yeah, there's hundreds of different ways that this can be done. So maybe we'll talk about some broad terms and some of the ways that I typically do it. But you'd find that you'd get 100 different answers to this depending on who you ask. Mm-hmm. So I guess at really broad strokes, let's say that we might start by identifying that there's a problem, which is what you just said. So we've got a problem because our police officers are having difficulty with PTSD symptoms. And we know this from other research that's been done. So somebody had already finished that job for us. They've gone out, they've assessed a lot of different police officers in a lot of different ways, and they've come to the conclusion that, yeah, relative to the rest of the population, our police officers are having more difficulty. And then we might sit down and go, well, okay, so we want to fix that problem because we want to help our police officers not have difficulties with PTSD anymore or to have fewer difficulties. What we might do then is go, well, what's causing the problems? And so it might be the exposure to traumatic events. It might be the other occupational stressors. It might be both of them combined. It might be that they're exhausted, which most police officers that I know right now certainly are.
Yeah.
So it might be, because we're asking so much of them, right? Mm-hmm. And we really do ask a lot of all of our PSP, and certainly that's true of our police officers. So if I'm a clinician or a clinical scientist or a researcher and I'm looking at this problem, I might start speculating. Then I'd go to the research literature and I'd say, well, what has other people done already? What do we already know helps and works? Because I don't really want to go back to the drawing board and start at the absolute zero as if I know nothing, because that takes a long time. So I take a look at what works and what doesn't. And then what I might do is say, okay, well, in other cases, this has helped. So what can I glean from that? What can I take from that existing research where this program or that program helped with PTSD after the fact or helped military with PTSD? Can I take anything from them and apply it to police officers? And if I think I can, then I might take that and go, okay, this might work. And then what I would do anyway, and this is where people start to get really quite different, is I would probably talk to some police officers And I would say, okay, so I want to solve this problem. I think it's a problem. And I would say to the police officers, do you agree it's a problem? And they, let's hope they say yes. And they say yes. And I go, this is what I'm imagining might help. Do you think it might help as well? And if the police officers come back and go, yeah, that makes sense, we think that might work for us, then after that, I'd say, okay, do you think that your police organization would be willing to help me to do this study? Because if we're going to test it, I'm going to need access to a lot of police officers, and we're going to need some time will have to be invested. And we're going to need, you're going to need help from the chief. You're going to need help from the deputy. Like, you're going to need a lot of help to get this done. And if they all come back and say, yeah, we're willing to help you, what are you imagining? Then we would design a study. We'd co-design it to some degree together, and we'd go, this is what I'm suggesting, what do you think? And then the police team might come back and go, yeah, you know what, Nick, that's a great idea, but there's no way we can make that work with shift work. Mm-hmm. Can we make these changes, or can we make these changes? And then we go, yeah, we can make those changes. Let's give this a shot. Once we've done that, then we go through and build a really detailed description of the study that we've planned. And if you're working with the university, which I recommend that you typically do, you might apply for funding. And there's lots of ways that you can apply for funding, but getting funding from the federal government is really, it can be quite challenging. So especially for health research. So you might apply to the Canadian Institutes for Health Research, in which case you're sending that study design forward to have a bunch of your colleagues blind peer review that so that they can evaluate whether the design is good, whether they think it's likely to do what you've suggested, whether there need to be changes made. And then they make a prioritization because there's lots of projects that they need to consider, because there's lots of things we need to do, from cancer treatments to diabetes to PTSD to panic to alcohol, right? Like, there's mm-hmm. lots of groups vying for money to try and help others. And so they would evaluate the quality of the design, and then they would help to do prioritization to say, well, we're going to prioritize this project. And at that point, then you as the researcher might win the funding. Now, if you want to win funding through CIHR, typically you have to be at one of the institutions. Universities are not the only ones, but they're common institutions that are eligible to apply for that kind of federal money. Mm-hmm. So if you win the federal money to do that, but you can also apply to other, that's not the only agency, of course, but that's one of them. So then let's say you win the funding from wherever you're getting the funding. If you're with a university, or if you're with one of the accredited research institutions, you're not there, you're not home free yet, you're not started. So you've now got the funding. Now you're going to go through the Research Ethics Board. So you're going to apply to the Research Ethics Board and tell them what you're going to do next. And you're going to say, here's what I want to do. And their job is to make sure that the participants are going to be kept as safe as possible, and that you're not going to breach any ethical principles. You talked about Shutter Island. That probably wouldn't pass ethics. I don't imagine that would be okay. In fact, a lot of the stuff we see on TV probably wouldn't be okay. But a lot of this came out of the original days of research before the Nuremberg trials, and before we really started to see the development of research ethics come to pass. So we've come a long way since stuff you might learn in an introductory psych course from the old days, so to speak. So now you're going to pass it. So at some point, you're going to go to this Research Ethics Board, and they're going to evaluate what you're doing. Once you've evaluated once they've done their evaluation, they're going to give you feedback, and they're going to say, okay, you have to make the following changes so that you're consistent with the ethical standards that we're going to hold you to. Now, once you've passed that ethics board, there might be a secondary ethics board, and you might have other groups that are going to evaluate to protect the participants and to protect the public as well. Once you've gone through those processes, then after that, you probably start to hire your team, because just the larger the study, you're probably going to need some extra people to help you out, because it's pretty rare you can do a big study, as just a single person. So once you've got them hired, then you've got to train them up. Mm-hmm. Once you've got them trained up, now you're finally at the point where we can go back to the police chief, for example, or to the team and say, okay, gang, here's what we want to do. We're ready. And then they go, okay. So you're ready to start recruiting. And at that point, you start recruiting people into the study.
I can see why.
And progress through it.
That's a long, such a long process. I see why people just go on social media and just go on blast and say wild statements that aren't actually true about anything, but, they can just make a lot of different claims. So it's like, oh, instead of looking up the research and evidence, I'll just say this. So
yeah.
I would, So in the work that you do, you work in like a academic setting. Now, one of the things I always found kind of interesting was, and maybe you could kind of dispel rumors about it, but you know, you see sometimes people on TV, so like Dr. Phil, and maybe he used to be a practicing psychologist or therapist, but now he's on a TV show. And some people say, well, he doesn't practice anymore. Is there any validity to that? Or can you still be, you know, up to date on the research and be capable of actually giving an informed opinion? Or is there a separation, like when you're actually doing clinical work versus the academic side, or whether you're on a TV show? Is there a difference between all those realms?
Well, it's a good question. I think that, so the talent, so I think the answer is it depends is the most honest answer that I can give you. So if you're going to do clinically based research, I think it really is important that you've done treatments and real clinical treatments and real clinical assessments, because you need to have experience there. And I do think you need to be kept up to speed and up to date on current practices. You need to be doing some practice yourself. But most clinical research does involve some practice. So because you're usually doing assessments or providing an intervention, but you might not be doing it for a single specific patient. You might be doing it as part of a larger team for the participants in your research study. And for most of the practicing clinical psychology professors that I know, for example, most of them are keeping patients most of the time, but not all of the time. And it ebbs and flows how many patients they take at any given time, because their job is to be professors as well, right? So they need to be teaching and doing university service and doing ongoing research. So you've still only got, you know, 60 or 70 hours in any given week, although we should all be working around 40, 45, mm-hmm. but you've only got about 60 or 70 practical hours in any given week. So you have to choose where you're investing your time. And clinical professors try and balance that, not necessarily in any given year, but certainly over the course of several years. You want to try and balance the ebb and flow of that. Now, on the other hand, if you're a clinician full time, you also are required to keep up to speed on the current research. So you've got still that responsibility to make sure that you're engaging in evidence-based practices and keeping up with whatever the best practices are at any given time. So, but your primary job, and in that case, if you're primarily a clinician out working in the community, your job is to provide clinical services, so to do assessment and treatment. So that's where you're going to spend the bulk of your time. Mm-hmm. And you may or may not be involved in research. You may or may not be taking ongoing courses at any given time. Again, over the course of your career, that'll probably ebb and flow over the course of any given time, right? So for the research teams, right, as you get, your research usually ebbs and flows as well. So when you've got a lot of research work that you're doing at any given time, it necessarily reduces the amount of time you have for clinical practice. Mm-hmm. But that usually doesn't hold for decades on end, right? Like that usually holds for 1 or 2 years at a time, and then it dips down a bit, and then you have the opportunity to take on more patients, and then as it comes up again, you'll take on fewer patients, and it ebbs and flows. So
is that like, so for yourself?
I don't know. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Well, and yeah, I was just kind of wondering, like, what's the time management like and what are the requirements? And it makes sense, like you're saying, it's just, it depends what exactly you're doing and what kind of your goals are. And then it's essentially comes down to time management. So whether you're in a class and then after you're working on the research and or you're in a clinic. So yeah, no, that totally answers it. And then I guess we can kind of move into some of the work you're doing now. I thought this, the video you sent me, and I'll put a link in the podcast description when we get it posted, but the Game Changers in Health Research. It's a short video. I think it was about 6 minutes you speak for in there. And I had so many questions out of this just from 6 minutes. I thought it was really good. And it's going on to the bigger discussion about the RCMP study. So can you kind of run us through this study that's ongoing right now and start wherever you like, but if you could tell us about this bigger study.
Sure. Yeah, we're really excited about the study. So the short version, you gave the long name at the beginning, and I won't bore everybody with that again, but the short version of it is we're calling it the RCMP study just for short, or the RCMP PTSD study just for short. So there's so many cool aspects to this study. It's certainly one of the largest that's ever been done in history. So we're very excited about that. It's required a tremendous amount of collaboration and effort from a huge team of people. So anybody who's interested in getting the details, I encourage them to visit the website at rcmpstudy.ca, because there's no way that I can give the credit to all of the many, many people that have gone into making this a reality. But it was about 7 years ago, give or take a little bit, where we started having conversations about what we might be able to do. And where we went was, look, we want to actually produce something that our police and other public safety personnel can rely on. We want to build something from the ground up that we know for sure is likely to help most of them most of the time. And we want to be able to provide evidence that it actually works. And so about 6 or 7 years ago, we began designing a system, and we said, well, let's take away the constraints of time, and let's pretend we don't have constraints on time and money and expertise. What would this look like? How would you actually build this? And we said, well, one of the first things that you'd do is you'd want to make sure that you were starting to provide the training inside of the training at depot. The other thing you'd want to do is you'd want to give them training based on something that you already know works. Mm-hmm. And you'd want to build a system that would allow for ongoing monitoring. And then you'd want to be able to compare a standard training group to this new augmented training group, which is something that's very rarely, if ever, done, especially with our police officers. You want to really test whether or not the thing you're doing is going to have a meaningful impact on the people who it's designed for. Mm-hmm. So we began having these conversations, and we talked to police officers, and we talked to RCMP, and we talked to clinicians, and we talked to different experts from across Canada and throughout North America. And we looked at the research that was available at the time. And one of the conclusions that we came to was, well, we want to help with PTSD, but PTSD isn't the only challenge facing police officers, and certainly not the only one facing our RCMP. They also have trouble with other disorders, like major depressive disorder or panic disorder or generalized anxiety disorder. And so we're not sure what kinds of challenges they're going to face, because we can't predict the future. But we need to give them a set of tools that are going to help across a wide variety of challenges. And so what we started looking into then was, well, what do we have for treatments that we know work that cross a bunch of different disorders? And the formal word for that is transdiagnostic treatments. So we said, okay, what transdiagnostic treatments do we have that we apply after somebody has had a mental health disorder to help them recover? And we said, those would be a good place to start, because if the skills and interventions that we use to help them recover after they have a disorder can be given to them before they have the disorder, well, that makes a certain amount of sense that should help to protect their mental health. Mm-hmm. So we looked through and did a literature review, and one of the best ones was one of them that I used, and I have used, and I still use to help my own patients, and it's called the Unified Protocol for Treatment of Transdiagnostic Disorders. And it was designed by Dr. David Barlow and Dr. Shannon Sauer-Zavala and a host of team members that they have as well. It's a big team that designed that. And at the time, there were more than 70 randomized controlled trials that demonstrated that intervention worked to protect or to repair mental health injuries after they occurred. So it's definitely one of the most evidence-based and evidence-supported treatments that we have available for mental health. And when we looked at it, we said, you know what? This looks like something that we could teach people in advance of having a mental health disorder, to give them these skills. And it looks like it would be really robust to helping. So we actually reached out to their team, and it was Dr. Shannon Sauer-Zavala herself who agreed to join our team to build this, to take what we knew worked for treatment and turn it into a training program. And so she began working with it.
So it's a preventative measure?
That's what we're trying to do.
Okay.
That's what we're trying to do is can we give you something that would be preventative? Mm-hmm. And so we began working with her to tailor it specifically for the RCMP. and to then, and then we worked with the RCMP. This was after we, I mean, there's a bunch of steps that I'm skipping here, obviously, but I'm giving you the short version. And we began to tailor it for the RCMP and integrate and prepare to integrate it into all of the RCMP depot training. And depot is a unique and fantastic environment to do this kind of a test, because we would be able to, because they move through a lot of different trainees in any given year, and there's tremendous controls there. So it's very much like a living laboratory, because the fidelity and the consistency of training is very, very high throughout all of the depot courses and across all the different people. And then all those people get deployed to a really wide variety of different situations and environments. So it makes for a really nice way for us to test, because if the thing works for the RCMP, if the intervention works for the RCMP, that means that it's more likely to be robust for other groups, because there's been so much diversity in the exposures that the RCMP members have had after receiving them. Because some of them went to small towns, some of them went to large towns, some of them went to different areas of the country, and so that's helpful for the study. So the other thing it allowed us to do, though, was create a cohort assessment. And so what that means is we've got, because you can't truly randomize the training such that I flip a coin and decide whether you're going to get the new training and you're going to get the original training. That's, the logistics for that became impossible. So instead what we did was we measured RCMP officers who were getting the standard training. And we measured 480 of them so that we knew what they looked like when they started training. And we followed them throughout the 26 weeks of depot training, and then we knew what they looked like after training as well. And then we followed them for 5 years thereafter. So it makes it a longitudinal study that has got a very large sample. Mm-hmm. We're also doing a lot of very intense measurements of them, because we want to make sure that we can understand all the different elements that might be impacting their mental health. Because that gives us all kinds of information, not only to test whether our changed version of the training will work, but also to see if there's other places where we could be doing a better job at creating interventions to help protect police officer mental health.
Can you talk about how you kind of measure some of that stuff?
You bet.
Before moving on, just how that looks or what works?
So we start with, the classic sort of measurement stuff that we do, which involves measuring people by way of survey. So we ask about 75 minutes worth of questions right at the beginning of their training. And those questions include a host of different things. So what they know about mental health, how they typically cope with different kinds of stressors, what their experiences have been so far. We ask about different psychological variables that we believe might be associated with risk and with resiliency. A host of different questionnaire series that get done very early on. And none of them are secret. They'll all be made available. We can talk about it a little bit, but there's a protocol paper that'll be released later this month, and people can pour through that and go over all of the details, because we're trying to be as transparent as possible. But in short, it starts with a very long survey. Then we also do a clinical interview. That clinical interview is conducted by one of the members of our team, who's a member of the research team, and it's a standard structured interview, basically assessing what kinds of symptoms somebody might have at the start of depot training. So that's what we call the full assessment. But then every month, we complete a monthly assessment that includes some screening tools that assess for the major mental health disorders that tend to be of interest, and provides immediate anonymous feedback back to our participants saying, here's where your mental health is at. So they do that every month, and it takes about 20 minutes. Then every day, they complete a daily survey that takes about a minute. And the daily survey is set up to get them to reflect on the last 24 hours of their life and get them to essentially make a record for themselves on their experiences for that last 24 hours. That eventually creates a living record so that they can look for patterns. So if every Tuesday morning, for some reason, you're looking back at your own mental health, every Tuesday morning, your mood is just terrible for some reason, that gives you the opportunity to make a tailored set of choices. Well, what can I do differently so that Tuesday mornings aren't quite so bad for me? Mm-hmm. Or what's happening on Monday night that's causing a problem that I could change? It also lets them record the events that have happened to them. And this is something that we wanted to do initially, but we didn't really understand until more recently just how important this was, particularly for our PSP groups. So if something we deploy our PSP to manage trauma, really, at the end of the day. That's what we're asking all of you to go to for us all the time, right? Mm-hmm. So there's regular exposures, and that's part of the job. And so I think what a lot of people don't realize, if we can do a little segue here, is that me as a regular civilian, I'm going to be exposed to probably way fewer than five, really potentially psychologically traumatic events in my whole lifetime. But a police officer could be exposed to five in a shift.
Yeah.
Right. So they right, like that's because they're the ones that are dealing with the rest of us being exposed to those potentially psychologically traumatic events. So I think back to that the Edmonton officer, my family and I, he probably did two more accidents like that before on the shift that he was just getting off. And when he went back to his next shift, dealt with another one the next day. Right. So for us, that was a major impact. But for him, it's what we're asking him to do all the time. So for our officers, we then give them the opportunity to record anything that they think was particularly impactful. Because what's going to impact a police officer changes, right? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I was going to let you continue. But one thing I was thinking too was with all these measurements, and you kind of mentioned it in the study, talking about wearable tech, because I guess relying on people to do daily logs, weekly logs, monthly check-ins, like a whole bunch of different things. I could see the benefit of having, say, you know, everybody's got their Apple Watch and it tells you your heart rate and all these different things. Is that kind of like an ultimate goal, is to have something that can just tell you, hey, you've got this going on, you need to get help in this way? Like, would that be kind of like a future tech?
Yeah.
Maybe an outcome.
Yeah, that's the last thing that we're asking our participants to do, is we're asking them to regularly measure their heart activity. And it's because we believe that your autonomic nervous system, which includes your heart, that when something particularly problematic happens to you, or when you've been exposed for too long to too much stress that hasn't been appropriately managed, we think that that's associated with changes to your autonomic nervous system, and that we can measure those changes in changes to your heart. Mm-hmm. And so we give all of our research participants access to a piece of technology that allows them to measure changes to their heart on a daily basis. And our ultimate goal is to be able to get ahead of the challenges, just like you're mentioning, so that they take 60 seconds, they pop a device on, it measures them for 60 seconds, you know, it's sort of a use it and walk away. And then over time, the device itself can help to flag for them, hey, you know, we think something might have gone wrong. Maybe you should go get some additional help. But to be able to do that very early, because it's kind of like your dentist, right? If you get mental health and dental health aren't all that different, in that if you can identify a problem earlier and go and get help earlier, mm-hmm. it can be easier to help manage the problem than if you wait until, right? Think of it like a cavity, right? If you catch it when it's a little tiny cavity, then it's way easier than if you wait until your tooth is falling out of your mouth, right?
Yeah.
Because
that's an interesting point.
Because you caught it early.
Yeah. It's and you brought that up in the Game Changers, where it's getting mental help should be just like going to the dentist or the doctor. And when something comes up, you know, you go in. Part of that is the stigma behind mental health or mental health, but also, I think a lot of people just don't know that they're experiencing anything. They don't know where to go. So, and obviously, you know, for the last couple thousand years, I don't think anybody really had a way to measure this. They didn't know it existed. And a lot of seeing is believing. So, you know, I can see my tooth is falling out, or I got a hole in my mouth. You know, I got to get that fixed. Whereas the mental side of things, it's very hard to understand. Even sympathize with somebody who's experiencing something, you know, you can't really say to them, I understand what you're going through, because you don't. All you can do is kind of say, like, I can try and help you or get you to wherever you need to be. So I thought that was a really good point. And that was one thing I was going to kind of mention. So I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah, it's a very exciting part. And you're right, seeing is believing. And we've seen this already with some of the participants. They're making really good use of monitoring their mental health, because when they do the self-report stuff, because you're right, sometimes you miss stuff with self-report too, and it's more time, it's more effortful. But there's two things that we've seen so far. First, people, we give them feedback so they can see their own mental health changing with respect to the charting we give our participants. And we've already seen evidence that our participants, when they see their mental health getting worse, because they can see it on the graph, right? So, but it's based on their own self-report, and they go, huh, my mental health is getting worse here. We've actually seen instances where that's allowed our participant to go and get help early. So they then turn around and they're like, whoa, 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 my mental health is getting, I'm starting to get symptomatic. But they're not clinical yet, so to speak. Like, they haven't passed that diagnostic threshold in the, according to the self-report measure yet, but their symptoms went up. Mm-hmm. And so because they saw the symptoms go up, they went and got mental health support, and then you watch their symptoms go back down. So that's one of the two things that we're really excited to be seeing, because you're right, seeing is believing, and they can watch it themselves change.
So how
the other thing we're seeing is that...
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask, like, so where, how far into the study are you, and what's the, is there an end date to all this?
Yeah, there is. So June 6th is when we've made the, we have the standard training group, and we all owe them a great debt of thanks. Because they're the ones that are sort of waiting the longest and did the biggest sort of leap of faith for us. They were getting the monitoring equipment, and they were participating in the study and doing the self reports, and they were getting the standard training. And they have to, the reason we owe them such a debt of thanks, well, one of them is because they have to wait the longest. But they're providing that group against which we can compare this new training that we're offering. And we launched the new training at Depo on June 6th of this year. We were delayed because COVID delayed just about everything. So we were delayed relative to what our original plan was. But on June 6th, we launched the new training at Depo. And we're are starting to add up inside Depo so that we can have that big enough sample that we need to run the test. So we're hoping that by the end of next year, we'll have enough participants that we'll be able to compare or start comparing the participants who received the standard training to the participants who received this new augmented training at Depo. And at that point, we'll keep monitoring them. But as they graduate from Depo, that's when we start trying to assess, well, how was your mental health support? So we measure them when they leave Depo, and then we measure them on the anniversary of their deployment for each of 5 years. And so every year that we go on with the study, it gives us a bit more data and lets us speak with a bit more authority about the impact that the training has had. So there is an end date to the study, so to speak. It's probably about 6 years from now, 7 years from now, give or take a little bit, depending on how long recruitment takes, because we don't force anybody to participate. They are all volunteers. But at that point, we will be able to compare our standard training group and how they did for their first 5 years of service relative to the augmented training group and how they did relative to their first 5 years of service. Now, we're going to make comparisons before then. And in fact, we already are. We're releasing all kinds of data as fast as we can. We're going through that peer review process because our first team, the standard training team, has already taught us a tremendous amount and helped to really improve our understanding of the mental health of police cadets and police in their early years of service in ways that have never been possible like this before for us. So we're very excited about that already, but to answer your question, we're several years away from the comparisons yet, at least two, but we're releasing the results just as fast as we can and as fast as they become available because we think we may have found something that can help.
Okay. Some of the definitions of things I kind of wanted to get into, and we kind of talked about a few of them before, but what's the difference when you hear psychologist, therapist? There's a few others out there, but like, can you kind of give us an idea of what they are and kind of what realm they fall into?
Sure. So psychologist itself, clinical psychologist, but the clinical is sometimes dropped, a registered psychologist. If I say that I'm a psychologist in that regard, it's a protected term. So what it means that I'm registered with the provincial body and I may also be licensed such that I can convey a diagnosis. So that's a protected professional term. It's sort of like saying that I'm a police officer or saying that I'm an accountant or saying that I'm a physician. It means that there's a larger body, a larger group that you're responsible for and that you've met a series of minimum requirements in order to claim that you have that term. Anybody can claim that they're a therapist or a life coach or a counselor. Those aren't protected terms. And those, that doesn't necessarily mean that those are people who are not helpful. It just means that there's differences in those terms. There's registered counselors and registered clinical counselors as well. And those are a different set of terms. So the challenge when we start talking about therapists and psychologists and all of these different phrases and terms is that it is ambiguous for the most part for the public. Because I could, if I'm a psychologist, I might say that I'm a therapist. That's not wrong. But if I'm a therapist and I'm not registered with the College of Psychologists in the province that I'm in, I shouldn't be calling myself a psychologist.
Yeah.
So it becomes a challenging environment, really, for people to understand who they're seeing and what kinds of qualifications and background and experience those people have. And even within the different professions, people have different kinds of experience. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when I'm working clinically, I only work with adults. I don't have experience with children. I don't work with children or adolescents. That's just not where my expertise is at all. So I would refer to somebody else in those cases. So I only work with adults. And I work with a very specific subset of adults. Usually I work with uniform members or PSP, and usually I stay focused on issues related to things like post-traumatic stress disorder. So even within the professions, the expertise can be narrowed quite specifically because that's what somebody's chosen to focus on. And that doesn't mean that there aren't people that don't focus on more than one area. But so it really becomes challenging to know sort of who you're interacting with. And the best way for you to understand that is to ask questions of that person. Mm-hmm. And then to make sure that you understand when they're using whatever that title is, what does that title mean for them? And what are their credentials? And how do they interact with the rest of the professional community when it comes to healthcare?
Yeah, that kind of makes me think of how all police officers are peace officers, but not all peace officers are police.
Oh.
So there's a difference, but one's a kind of a broader term. And I never kind of thought of psychologists and therapists and counselors and everything else you have under there as that, you know, kind of working like that. But yeah, that's very interesting. And I mean, people got to know who to talk to when they have certain problems. And yeah, it can be a whole mess and you just don't know where to start. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect analogy, actually. It's all right with you. I'm going to use that myself going forward. That's a really good analogy.
One of the things too I wanted to kind of cover was we talked about this one was post-traumatic injuries versus the more common term PTSD. So what's the difference between those?
Okay, so post-traumatic stress disorder is a diagnosable mental health disorder. And for you to be diagnosed with that, you have to meet a series of specific symptom criteria. And we use diagnoses to help us guide things like treatment or intervention planning. So we want to make sure that we are mapping the right kind of treatment onto the right kind of symptoms to get you the best possible outcomes. That's why we create diagnostic categories. I don't do it. There's a whole team of people that does mm-hmm. this. But that's why they create diagnostic categories. So PTSD is one of the diagnostic categories. But the problem that we ran into over the last probably 40 years since the diagnosis first came out is that it's become associated with a fair amount of stigma. And there's people who say, you know what, I don't want to be diagnosed with a disorder because that harms me personally or professionally or because I'll be looked at differently. And there's some evidence that that's all true, that they can be looked at differently and that it can cause problems for them. So it was Stéphane Grenier, who was a military officer many years ago, who now argued, rightfully so, that PTSD doesn't really capture what we're seeing. He said, we really need to change the language because this is an injury. This is not a failing. This isn't something that you failed to do. This is something that happened to you, and it caused you harm. And so something that happened to you that caused you harm, that sounds a lot more like an injury. Hmm. And what Stéphane Grenier argued at the time was it happened while you were in operational service. So he said, this seems to me, maybe we should call it an operational stress injury to try and reduce the stigma and to remind people that this was something that happened to the person, that it was harm they took while engaged in serving and protecting their communities. So that became much more popular. And then as that became more popular, there was an expanded argument that got made that said there's more than just PTSD. I could have any number of mental health disorders that come as a result of my service. And so that's when people started saying, well, operational stress injuries might include PTSD, but they might also include major depressive disorder or panic disorder or alcohol use disorder. And then they went one step further, and this is the most recent one, wherein they said, you know what? The injury doesn't necessarily have to have happened while you were on operational service. It might be that your operational duties and that your operations themselves increased your vulnerability such that it was the, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. So let's expand it and let's say just post-traumatic stress injuries much more broadly. It doesn't have to have been it doesn't have to be that the event happened while you were on duty. It could be that the event happened at any point in time, but it's still an injury.
Mm-hmm.
And so post-traumatic stress injuries is a much broader category. So in the same way that we were talking about with police officers and peace officers, all mental disorders that follow exposure to one or more psychological or potentially psychologically traumatic events could be considered post-traumatic stress injuries. And we like to use that term because in many ways it is less stigmatizing, at least right now. And it does, I think, better reflect the fact that it wasn't a failing inside the person. Mm-hmm. It was that we asked a police officer, for example, to go to 500 car accidents and pull people out of car accidents and manage those scenes over and over. And they did it with compassion and support. And it's a very human response to look at the situation there and go, these people are hurt, right? That kind of empathy and sympathy, we want our police officers to have that because I think it helps make them better police officers. But it also means that they're at risk because while they're being empathetic and sympathetic to those people, they're still human beings under those uniforms who are being exposed to things that can cause harm. And they're doing it to protect and serve.
Yeah. And I wonder how that kind of will look in the future for some people. Cause you know, some people get on the job and the very first thing they see, they have a claim, you know, they're saying I've got mental health, issues out of this. And then there's people who go 20, 25 years and apparently have nothing, but maybe in retirement, stuff comes up. So it's just, I wonder what the difference between people is and is it a lot to do with your mindset coming into the job? Is it your prior experiences, growing up? I imagine it's a whole host of factors. It'd probably be, well, you would need a pretty big study over a lot of years to figure it out. But there's so many questions to ask on this stuff. And one of the things, one of the stats that I thought was really interesting that you gave in the Game Changers video was that 10% of the population has a mental health disorder, and approximately for first responders, you're looking around 45%. So is that a number that was measured? Or is, you know, where does that kind of come from?
Yeah, that's, well, so let's do that in two steps. You're absolutely right that you need a big study to do all of the things because it's going to be a combination of events. And that's what the RCMP study is trying to tackle. It's a really big attempt to try and tackle that big study piece. That's why we're so excited about it and why Canadians should be very proud that our government and our RCMP are investing the time and the money and the effort into doing that because that's where we're going to get some of our best information to help as many people as possible going forward so that we can understand exactly what you're asking. Like, why is it that day one, this poor person ended up having huge troubles, but this person made it 25 years and they were okay or ostensibly okay, as you mentioned. So why? What's the difference? So that we can learn how to make sure that that we're giving the best tools possible to everybody because they should have the best care possible. So that's the first piece. The second piece that you're at, and it'll take more than just one study, even as big as the RCMP study to do this. It'll be an ongoing series of studies.
Mm-hmm.
But the second question that you're asking is whether
the first responders are at about 45% for mental health.
Yeah, like whether they're at 45%. And this is a more complicated question, but without going into a whole lot of academic pedantics about it and boring everybody. So that study was the result of us assessing we invited nearly 10,000 public safety personnel, first responders from across Canada to participate in the study. And we used really well-validated self-report screening tools to assess their symptoms. And there was nearly 7,000 of them who participated. And we used those self-report screening tools. We used the algorithms associated with them to get a good estimate of how likely it is that somebody would screen positive, or how likely it is that if we had them meet with a clinician, that they might receive a diagnosis of a mental health disorder. And so that's how we were able to come to that number. So that's peer-reviewed research that is publicly available now for people to go through, and they can read. And it's not a perfect study. No study is. But it was one of the largest studies that we've ever seen done in Canada to this respect, or for this respect. And so far, when we've done other work, so Dr. Rose Ricciardelli has done work with correctional workers across Canada. And based on what she's seeing so far from those more nuanced, more detailed assessments and studies that she's doing specifically, it looks like the numbers are holding, which is concerning. Mm-hmm. So we think the numbers are probably pretty reliable, and we think they make a fair amount of sense in that it's really speaking to what we're asking all of you to do. So we're asking you to manage tremendous numbers of potentially psychologically traumatic events. We're asking you to do it while you're experiencing the standard organizational and operational stressors that any human being working in an organization experiences, right? Difficulties with colleagues and difficulties with interacting with other people. And we're coupling that with shift work, mm-hmm. and a lot of uncertainty. And we're also doing that while asking you all to do more and more with less and less every single year, because that's what we think we want all of the time. I don't think I've ever met anybody in the PSP world who says, yeah, we're fully staffed. We've got plenty of staff. No problem.
Yeah.
You know, staff and staff to spare.
Well, and so I wonder,
we think the numbers are reliable.
Has there been any measure since all the big events like Black Lives Matter stuff? You've had COVID. Like, there's a whole bunch of things that have happened in the last 2 years alone. Violence against police is up. We see people just are more confrontational with police. They're not afraid to get in your face. Everybody, as soon as they, you know, pull out a camera, now they are the ones with wielding the stick, so to say. So has there been any real studies since maybe in the last 2 years?
I haven't seen. I was actually asked to look this up just a couple of days ago, and we're in the process of taking a look. I didn't find anything at quick glance when we were doing this study, but we're actually looking into it now. Ironically, one of the problems with doing exactly what you're asking is that in order to run that study, we need to ask the very people who are already overtaxed now to work with us again, and we need to add to their workload. And it's a big ask of our police officers right now.
So their baseline is already pretty, you know, kind of skewed one way.
Yeah. Because you're exhausted. Yeah. Like what we're hearing from the officers that I have that are friends of mine and colleagues, they're exhausted now.
Yeah.
Right. So we're hearing about problems with recruitment across the country with trying to recruit new police officers and increased numbers of police officers who are leaving the profession for, I imagine, many of the reasons you just mentioned. So to run a mental health study, I think we probably do need to, but there's no reason that I can imagine that would lead me to believe that police officer mental health has gotten better as a function of the last 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that just doesn't make sense to me, right? So if it was at 44% across all the PSP before COVID and all of the social events, I don't imagine it got better. Mm-hmm. So my guess would be it got worse. And it's a concerning cycle challenge that we're now walking into. So if you've got police officers who are stressed and we're going to reduce the number of police officers who are available as a function of, you know, as recruitment goes down and retirements go up, that means the number of serving officers necessarily goes down, right? So if you were having difficulties because they were overtaxed before, they're not going to be less overtaxed. So we're going to make them more overtaxed. And as we increase that stress on our police officers as a community, that's going to mean that it's more likely people will take early retirement or change jobs. And it also makes it less likely that we're going to be able to convince new people to join the force. Because we're showing them this is how we're treating our police officers.
Yeah.
it's that makes a harder sale, right? Not only may you have mental health challenges, but your community may not support you at all, and you may be assaulted, you may be attacked, you'll be under constant scrutiny. This becomes a hard sell job, and we needed more police officers than we had before COVID started. So, I mean, at the risk of sounding a little doomsayerish, and I certainly don't mean that, I think it's an area of serious concern right now. We need to look at how we're treating our police officers, and we need to look at how we're protecting their mental health, because we depend on them to protect and serve the rest of us.
Yeah, well, so, you're not wrong. And where, so kind of what would you say would be a good place if somebody's having some sort of mental health issue, crisis, whatever it might be, where should they start to seek help?
Well, it right now, I think one of the best places that they can seek help, depending on which, well, across Canada right now, we have a couple of different versions of what we call PSPNet. And PSPNet is a real online evidence-based mental health intervention that we've seen is providing really good mental health supports for our police officers. And it's not self-help. We have a self-help version if that's what somebody wants, but there's also a clinical version where you have a real therapist who's there that meets with you once or twice a week or interacts with you once or twice a week. It provides all kinds of confidentiality, and it doesn't require that you go through your AFAP program or that you tell anybody that you're engaging with that help. So you can reach that by going to www.pspnet.ca. You can also go online to the CIPSCRT website, where the Canadian Institutes of Public Safety Research and Treatment, and you can gain access to webinars and additional mental health information and supports. And there's also links there that can take you to other psychology support systems that are available. Depending on which province you're in, you can also, of course, always go to the Provincial College of Psychologists. That can be a great place to start. There's certainly other professionals and mental health professionals that can be available to help as well. But those are good starting points, and they can lead you to other good safe spaces with respect to finding registered mental health care practitioners.
Wow.
That's the one thing that I would recommend.
I didn't even know that many things were out there. I would have just gone to my GP doctor and been like, where do I go? That's the only thing I knew that existed. So no, that's really, really good, really informative. I'll put as many of the links to these things in the podcast, the episode description, so that people can click around, look up various studies, because you sent me a few that I've been taking a look at. I'll put some of the links here for the all the different forms of help that they can get. Is there anything kind of coming up in the future? Any big studies or work? You writing a book? Anything?
I may write a book at some point in the future. The big pieces that we're working on right now, we have done an extension of the RCMP study to look after some public safety personnel, 50 municipal police, 50 firefighters, 50 public safety communicators, and 50 paramedics. So we're just working through that study right now, and we're hoping to have some of the results available just after Christmas from that study. There'll be a host of different results that we're hoping to make available from the RCMP study over the next over the coming months. They should be coming out. So those are two of the big projects that we're working on right now. If you go to the CIPSCRT website, though, you'll also see that thanks to the Public Health Agency of Canada, we have several funded projects that are being built such that they don't cost anything, but that they're providing frontline supports in a variety of different ways to our public safety personnel and their families. So I encourage you to visit that website and take a look at some of the services that are available right now across Canada and that don't cost anything, thanks to some tremendous federal funding that was specifically targeting supporting our public safety personnel and our healthcare workers they've been really on our front line for the last 2 years, and they need more supports than we've been giving them as a community. And so that's a really terrific way to start, thanks to those investments.
Awesome. Yeah, we appreciate the work that you do. Where can people follow your work, or where can they follow you?
That's a great question, Nathan. I'm not great on social media. probably the best way to follow me is to follow the CIPSCRT Twitter account and the CIPSCRT other social media accounts, which I should have committed to memory better than I do. But we have an all this translation team that regularly puts out the results and the work that we have there. They get transmitted through the SIPCert social media work there. There's web listservs that people can choose to add themselves through the SIPCert website. And we try and make sure that as our results become available and as our projects become available to everybody, it gets shared there. Because they're much better at doing that than I am with respect to social media and sharing.
Yeah, social media, this is just too much of it out there. Even for me, I got this podcast on a couple platforms and that's it. I don't have time to do all the things that are out there. But we had you here for just over an hour. I don't want to keep you all day. I have lists of questions I could go through, but we'll definitely have to look to have you back on. I think the work you're doing is very important, and lots of people want to know about this. I had lots of questions about these things. So it was great having you on. And is there anything you think we missed? Anything you want to touch on?
No, I'm delighted to have done this. I'm happy to come back in the future if you'd like. And I guess something I'd say is, because I don't think they hear it nearly enough, all of our public safety personnel need thanks. But I most certainly want to thank every one of our police officers. From the officer who I will never get to meet from when I was young, all the way to all of you who are currently serving uniform. I'm very grateful for all of the work that you do and for every one of them who puts on a uniform and goes back out and serves every single day to keep us all safe. So thank you for that service, and we all appreciate it. And we sincerely hope that we can do a better job of protecting your mental health going forward.
Great. It's appreciated. And just hang on the line. We'll chat with you here just before you go. So, yeah, but thank you for coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you.